From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR's correspondents from around the globe. I'm Kevin Beasley. This week, corruption and shoddy building add to the human toll of China's earthquake. How the Chinese media is reporting the story, and the slow reconstruction of Afghanistan. The Chinese authorities have promised to deal severely with anyone found responsible for shoddy state building work. The announcement followed the collapse of almost 7,000 school classrooms in the recent earthquake. Thousands of students are believed to have died as a result. Now, some parents are trying to force an investigation into their allegations of local corruption, greed, and mismanagement. NPR's Louisa Lim reports from the scene of one school collapse in Wufu Town.
Funeral music is broadcast at Fuxing Primary School. Here, parents line the driveway, each wearing a black armband and carrying the photo of a lost child. Their faces are drawn with sleeplessness and grief. At least 127 students died here when their three-story school collapsed on them. The buildings around it are largely undamaged, and the parents are angry. We parents don't believe our children died in a natural disaster, says Chen Hupei. His eyes red. The disaster was man-made. His 10-year-old son, Chen Xin, who loved roller skating and basketball, died in a ground floor classroom because he couldn't escape in time. One parent taps the steel rebar in the concrete pillars. They believe there was too little steel in the building's structure. Its foundations weren't sunk deep enough, and there were no emergency exits. I believe the government meant well when it built this school, Chen Hupei says, but some corrupt officials were saving money to pocket themselves. This school was built in 1989, when the safety guidelines weren't so strict, but it should have been subject to safety checks twice a year under a law passed 2 years ago. The deputy director of Mianzhu Education Bureau, Zhu Qi, is here to meet parents. But he denies responsibility. Building safety is a matter for the construction bureau, he says, standing shoulder to shoulder with the school's headmaster. I'm not passing the buck. We'll take responsibility for whatever is ours to deal with. None of these other buildings fell down, shouts an angry parent, gesturing around as he follows the official. Here, many notice the town's government buildings are also largely undamaged. It's a pattern that's been repeated elsewhere. That's because China's building schools on the cheap. Regulations allow a budget of $350 per square meter to build government offices in towns. Schools in one nearby county cost just $64 per square meter. And money is at the heart of what went wrong here. They're too evil-hearted, shouts one parent. She's accusing the school authorities of renting out the newer one-story classrooms, which survived unscathed, to a business to make money and moving their children into the older building. They condemned our children to death, she cries. I've never signed any rental contract, answers headmaster Wang Weiyong, denying the allegations. And the relevant authorities never told me the school building was unsafe. The parents are also angry at the school's teachers, all of whom escaped the building and fled the scene. Look at my hands, one parent told me earlier. I dug through the rubble to look for my children. Then look at the teacher's hands. Some, like Chen Hupei, believe the law and the central government are on their side. The government will help us get justice, he says. The government is good. It's just certain officials who aren't. Here's my daughter's dictionary of proverbs, says Mother Yang Rong, clutching to her chest a book she's just found. It was in a pile of school bags lying in the debris. She's just opened the front page and found, written inside the front cover, the word mother.
The parents here have built their own shrine. They've gathered desks from the classroom. On the desks are the pictures of some of the children who died here. Incense is burning in front of those desks. And there's a sign running across the top of the shrine, which says, "Let us remember with pain our children who died in vain."
The cameras click as one young woman breaks down, stroking the photo of her bright-eyed son as if it might bring him back. The parents want journalists and the outside world to bear witness to their suffering. Only then can they bring about change. Louisa Lim, NPR News, Sichuan Province, China.
For many Chinese journalists, the devastating earthquake and the forthcoming Beijing Olympics in August are the biggest stories yet in their careers. Many of them say that they've unprecedented freedom to report both stories, although that freedom does not appear to extend to political matters. However, as NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports from Chengdu, many Chinese reporters are encouraged by what they consider to be an increasingly open reporting environment.
Many young Chinese reporters have never been thrown into a story that is so challenging, physically, professionally, and emotionally. In the devastated township of Hanwang, Xinhua News Agency photojournalist Pei Xin roams among the crumbled buildings, photographing the rescue workers looking for signs of life. He says that from a personal angle, it's hard to take.
When we got here, we were hoping to see miracles, but it's been too hot and too long since the earthquake, and the rescuers are mostly digging up corpses. We're disappointed, and our hearts are very heavy.
On a professional level, though, Pei says he's encouraged.
Domestic and foreign media have had equal opportunities to get into the disaster zones and report, and the locals have been pretty cooperative. I think this relatively freer reporting environment is a sign of more openness.
In Chengdu, Xiamen evening news reporter Liu Rong is waiting for a government press conference to begin. She says that her paper has given her an entire page to fill each day as she sees fit.
Our paper hasn't assigned any particular angle for us to cover. Many of our colleagues are told by their leaders what kind of stories they're supposed to find and report on. But we're free to report the story as we see it.
Chinese reporters say that the depth and volume of reporting on this disaster is unprecedented. Like other papers, Liu's is devoting two-thirds of its space to earthquake reporting. Sichuan TV and other channels have broadcast days of around-the-clock earthquake news. Here, China Central Television follows a family as rescuers free their daughter from the rubble of a collapsed school in Mianzhu City. The dramatic images of rescue workers and grieving families could be from any disaster story around the world. The media have also played a crucial public service role. They've helped quake victims to find missing relatives and encouraged the public to donate money and to do volunteer work. But the government is not eager to see reports that criticize their response to the earthquake as too slow, or reports that discuss official corruption and the shoddy construction of schools which collapsed and killed students. Yu Guoming, a leading media scholar at People's University in Beijing, says these issues will come up later. When the rescue efforts are over, he says, we will enter a period of reconstruction and reflection, and I'm sure that issues such as building quality will come to the surface then. Propaganda officials fear losing control over journalists, and they try to prevent them from reporting outside their own provinces. One Chinese colleague who spoke off the record said that quite a few Chinese reporters defied government orders not to travel to Sichuan. Some of them even paid their travel expenses out of their own pockets. Yu Guoming says this shows an increasing sense of professionalism among Chinese journalists. Chinese journalists are quite aware of their social and professional responsibilities, he says, and they're very willing to actively cover this story, even though the system sometimes limits their ability to do so. Before the earthquake, Chinese media were still busy criticizing the exiled spiritual leader, the Dalai Lama, and Western media following the unrest in Tibet. Soon they will be welcoming the world to the Beijing Olympics. For China's young journalists, this year offers a crash course in understanding their own country and explaining it to the outside world. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Chengdu.
Coming up, the slow pace of development in Afghanistan.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with super-handling all-wheel drive. More information is available at Acura.com.
When the Taliban regime was driven from Afghanistan in late 2001, the country was in a shambles. Decades of war and conflict had stripped Afghanistan of even the most basic infrastructure and services. So the United States and other nations stepped in, with pledges to rebuild Afghanistan from the ground up, and billions of dollars in foreign aid poured in. Yet despite some progress in cities like Kabul, much of Afghanistan looks the same today as it did 7 years ago. NPR's Soraya Sahadi-Nelson reports on the challenges of rebuilding Afghanistan.
Afghan Governor Arsalan Jamal is in a bind. He wants to build a gate between two walled compounds that house a girls' school here in Khust. That way, the girls won't need to walk outside and risk attack in this volatile province southeast of Kabul. But in Afghanistan, he's forced to go hat in hand to a local American military team. So the governor invites Navy Commander Erica Sauer to the school. She is the new commander of the U.S. Provincial Reconstruction Team, or PRT.
Since this was a very small one, we have the next building, and we were thinking of having a gate there.
The governor is a tad nervous as he gets to the point.
There is a need for the gate, so, especially if you send a yard or somebody to look at some of the requirements. This could be a very easy fixture. Mm-hmm. A very easy fixture. And I can show you some of it.
Jamal says he's embarrassed to have to ask Sauer for something as simple as a gate. But he says he has no choice, given he has not provided a single dollar for development by his own government or anyone else. He adds that getting funds for the gate from the Afghan Education Ministry in Kabul would take years.
Yeah, I know this. I'm bringing the PRT commander, governor, of course, working with her, just to tell her that we need a gate here. And this gate will cost everything if they do, everything they've listened to me, it will cost them $3,000 to $4,000, everything. Yeah, we have a long way to go.
Still, this province is one of the luckier ones. Khust, a former Taliban stronghold that for a time was home to Osama bin Laden, is booming with American construction. Roads are being paved. Government centers are springing up, even in remote areas along the border with Pakistan. 53 schools will be built in Khust this year. The United Arab Emirates also funded a sprawling new university campus here. A couple hundred miles to the north, Habiba Surabi envies the attention Khust gets. She is the governor of Bamiyan, one of the most peaceful of Afghanistan's 34 provinces. It is also one of the most impoverished and underdeveloped. Surabi says many of the children in Bamiyan still attend school outdoors, in tents if they are lucky. Of the roads that crisscross this mountainous province, only 1 mile is paved. Work on connecting her province to Kabul via neighboring Wardak province is going nowhere. She says Khost, on the other hand, is getting a $60 million road to connect it to neighboring Paktia province.
And that road will be built within 18 months. But this is 3 years that we are talking about the road between Maidan Wardak and Bamyan. And the people of Bamyan and the provincial council requested that the Ministry of Public Work or donor agency could start it from Bamyan side. They promised that they will do, but we didn't see anything.
Based on 3 months of interviews ranging from ministers in Kabul to villagers living in remote areas, it's clear this type of frustration is rampant across Afghanistan. Everyone knows money is pouring in. The United States alone has pledged $6 billion in aid here since 2002. But the problem, Afghans say, is that there are too many people making decisions on how and where the money should be spent. Donor countries, non-governmental organizations, even foreign nations' militaries. Some consult with the government in Kabul, others with local leaders. But there's not enough coordination. No one here or abroad can say with certainty what all the projects in Afghanistan are, or where they are, or how much money has been spent. Even Afghan ministries don't share information with each other and are widely accused of corruption. But Afghan officials' biggest beef seems to be with foreign donors. Officials in Kabul complain that they've had too little say in where foreign aid goes, even though the government's ability to handle that aid has grown exponentially in recent years. Muhammad Ehsan Zia is the head of the Ministry of Rural Rehabilitation and Development. He estimates only a quarter of the aid coming into Afghanistan is channeled through his government.
The problem is that we need to take people of Afghanistan into confidence. And the only entity that can take people into confidence is their government.
And the lack of Afghan confidence in their government is growing. Syed Muzaffar owns a small construction supply shop in Bamyan City.
They come here, the parliament members and ministers. They promise they'll bring electricity and roads, but nothing comes of it. Maybe it's that we're the wrong tribe or that we don't have terrorists destroying everything. It doesn't pay to be peaceful.
That sentiment worries Governor Surabi, who fears her people might be driven to civil unrest if things don't change. She says it's hard not to feel angry when they see where the aid goes. Much of the foreign development is concentrated on war-torn areas in the south. The contracts are often let to foreign companies, who in turn subcontract with other foreign or Afghan builders. Yet such projects often languish because it's too unsafe to work. Like the Kajaki Dam here in the southern province of Helmand. American engineers are trying to rebuild the half-century-old U.S.-built dam and power plant in what is the heart of Taliban country. It's a $16 million project that would provide power to more than 1 million households. But the repair work was suspended for months because of Taliban attacks. It has since resumed, but the engineers say it'll take more than a year to finish. That is, if there are no further delays. Muhammad Hashim Mayar worries that time is running out to get the development strategy right. He is deputy director of Akbar, a non-governmental organization in Kabul that drafted a recent report about problems with foreign aid here. Mayar says it's clear Afghans are impatient.
Have these construction changed the life of the poor people? No. 75% of our people are living in the villages, in the rural areas. Little work has been done for them.
Government ministers in Kabul say they are working to change that. They hope to gain more control over foreign aid with a 5-year strategy they will unveil to donors at a conference in Paris next month. Soraya Sarhadi Nelson, NPR News.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Beasley.